The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
Welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go? I am your host, Soraya, and this week on the show we have Gregory Sams, who has a rather interesting history, and we're going to be talking about his book, Son of God, and maybe a little bit about his new book that just came out as well. Are you with us, Gregory?
I'm right here with you.
All right, and do you want to tell people a little bit about your history?
In terms of my business, life as a change agent history, started off with natural foods in this country. When I was 18, I opened in partnership with my brother the first ever restaurant in the UK to be selling natural and organic foods. That was in 1967, and called Seed Restaurant. And it was frequented by John and Yoko, Mark Bolan, various. You know, it was the only kind of cool eating place in London in the 60s, and we also gave away free food to those with no money. And it was the first place that people ever tasted things like brown rice, sesame seeds, seaweed, miso, millet, buckwheat, all sorts of nuts and beans. You know, those things had never figured anywhere in the British diet. People wanted to eat that stuff at home, so that led to opening up a shop so they could buy these things, cook them at home. Because it was a small shop, I had to import stuff for it, and other shops, of course, wanted then to sell this stuff. So that turned a Series Grain Store turned into Harmony Foods, which became Whole Earth Foods, and pretty soon, like within a few years, I had a massive warehouse, 55,000 square feet, hundreds of tons of stuff going in and out each week. A nightmare as this old, you know, hippie, seat of his pants businessman running this big business. Things got very difficult at one point, and I created this brand new product, which I thought was going to save the country, the company, designed all to be manufactured outside, so we didn't need more overhead staff or premises, which were crippling us. And this new product, I came up with a name for it, which was Veggie Burger, which had never been in the language before, such that I could trademark the word. And I ended up leaving Whole Earth Foods because our bankers and investors weren't impressed with the new product. They wanted, you know, direct action. So I went off and ran this as a virtual company out of my spare bedroom, as according to the original plan, and it just took off. There was a black hole out there of people who, you know, wanted something other than pizza and sandwiches to feed themselves. And it opened up a whole market for vegetarian foods in this country. Then that led on. I got out of it after 6 or 7 years. It got into a big company again, and I just cut loose at that point. I sold it and got into chaos theory after a couple of years of having advance installment on my retirement. And that led me to open up a whole shop, and I'm going to go on for hours here. Any questions on what I said so far?
Well, how do you open up a shop on chaos theory? That got me when I read that.
Well, I was seduced by the whole idea of chaos theory and the self-organizing properties of the universe, really, you know, anything in it. But also, as an old hippie, by these wonderful swirling cosmic fractal images that one got out of the Mandelbrot set and other fractals. So the shop sold, we had the few books. There was only a dozen or so books addressing the subject then. You could fill a small library now. But books, toys that were chaotic toys, and then lots of fractal-based things like posters, postcards, T-shirts, mug, drinking mat, beer mat pads, and even fractal jigsaw puzzles, which were awesome because they're really fiendish things to produce. I wish I'd have kept one of those for my archives. And then once a month, we'd have a Salon de Chaos, and we'd get a top scientist who was one of the originators of chaos theory would come in, and they'd give a little lecture to people or demonstration and slideshow. So it was a really happening place. And but for me, I wanted to get the message across about how everywhere you go, you see things self-organizing into functioning structures, whether it's rainforest or weather systems or the shoe industry for human beings. I mean, that's self-organized. Nobody ever, 30 years ago said by 2013 we're going to have this many different colors of, wading boots and high-heeled shoes and sandals and tongs and slippers. And, we've got this whole array of things to wear on our feet. And that's how things self-organize. And in big contrast to that is how we run ourselves, which is this top-down where we think some things important, that they've got to be organized from above, deterministically planned, how we look after our health or how we decide what foods are safe to eat. And then we end up with, the pharmaceutical industry dictating, how we heal ourselves and banning certain, getting certain things banned, like natural remedies and herbs. And in the food industry, we end up with, fast food joints all over the place, genetically modified food, high sugar fat. And this is really a direct result of the state's involvement in the chain. That message led to my first book, which has now been updated from 1998 to 15 years later. And it's now called The State is Out of Date, We Can Do It Better. And I've just given you the gist of what it's about. and it came out on October 1st as a very cup of coffee priced digital book, which was the same day that the U.S. government shut down, went out of business. So that was really accidental, brilliant timing.
yes, absolutely. And I can see how Son of God came out of that whole chaos theory idea as well, right?
Well, yeah, in a sense. It took spiritual matters, in The State is Out of Date, I'm looking at the coercive, organized state versus sort of natural self-organization of our society. And in Son of God, subtitled Discover the Self-Organizing Consciousness That Underlies Everything, in that book, I'm looking at the difference between what organized religions have given us and a sort of a natural spirituality that people developed around the world, which was based on an awareness that we weren't the only living entity in the universe, but part of a living universe, one infused with consciousness of which we are a wonderful part.
And how, what made you decide to write this?
I had long ago had this revelation that the sun was a conscious being. It happened when I was 17 years old. And it wasn't something that changed my life in a big way. It just always made a difference to sunsets and sunrises. I didn't talk about it to people because people think that's a weird, nutty idea. And But everything I ever heard or felt kind of underlined that feeling. And then it was in 2000, right at the very first day of the year 2000, that I decided this was going to be my book. I had about three or four ideas on the table I'd been mulling about in my head. I decided this was going to be my book, and how do I go about trying to convince people that this nutty idea is worth considering? And yeah, first point obviously is that wherever, you know, from thousands of years, wherever you went in the world, people intuitively recognized that the actual source of the light of life was a living entity itself, and they gave it divine status because of the source of life. And this wasn't knocked out as an idea by modern science showing us anything different at all. It was knocked out by a very jealous new church, Christianity, when it became the dominant force or spiritual church of the Roman Empire. And at that point, sun worship became the worst crime on earth. And you know, far more people died because they were horribly killed, in fact, because they held on to some ancient spiritual beliefs than that Christians were ever fed to the lions by the Romans. It was a real onslaught. And after enough generations, we've just lost that intuitive connection. So my idea was to bring the sun back out of the cold and reconnect us with some intuitive, hardwired knowledge.
Okay, all right. And in this book, though, you don't just postulate as a simple status that just the sun is conscious, but you kind of talk about a prevailing consciousness through all systems.
Well, that's right. I pick up an awful lot of, when I looked into science, of course, what do scientists know about the sun and the cosmos? And that was more interesting to me. I mean, it's not a history of sun worship, or, you know, the Egyptians thought this and the Japanese thought that and the Norsemen thought these, and they all had similar thoughts. But it's really looking at what we know scientifically today, and when you recognize the inevitable consciousness of the sun, and which is built up of hydrogen initially. You know, stars create all the atoms in the periodic table are forged in a star from hydrogen and a little bit of helium, coming out of cosmic dust. And you've got, as we know, it's the electromagnetic force guiding other physical laws, which shape that cosmic dust into, in the case of our sun, an organism with seven different layers, some of which rotate around each other at different speeds, all of which perform different functions, and which turn, and the main function is turning matter into energy. So you've got the electromagnetic force, which is energy, shaping matter into a structure which then turns matter into energy, and that energy, in us is transmuted as the light of life. So you've got this, when you pursue that and what's going on there, and you look at how stars are connected to each other through electromagnetic fields, sending information back and forth, it's hard to escape the conclusion that this electromagnetic force itself, which pervades everything in the universe, is some primal conscious force itself. And it fulfills all the kind of, if you want to tick the boxes for the prime divine force of the universe, it gets them because it's everywhere. You know, even if you're out in deep space, and you see nothing but the light of a distant galaxy, that's the electromagnetic force infusing every bit of that space. And it's also credited as being that which makes matter appear solid, even though it's 99.9% empty space between the atoms and the electrons. It's the electromagnetic force in there which is giving it that identity or character. So it's everywhere, and that's what the sun exudes. The sun is like our local manifestation, our local agent of that divine force. And it is, and that brings the light to us. So, I mean, originally there was a subtitle to my book, Son of God, and that was, maybe, if you start
God, it may be everything to us, but it's just a bright spark in the mind of the cosmos. Let me just come in with a great little quote from Goethe, Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, the great German philosopher, which is that he came out with this on his deathbed. He was about to die, at which point he confided to one of his closest assistants, because you couldn't talk about sun worship in those days, you'd be, you know, dead. But he confided that he was prepared, quotes, to revere the sun, which is likewise a manifestation of the highest being, and indeed the most powerful, which we, the children of the earth, are allowed to behold. That was 1832.
Wow, okay. Are you familiar at all with the electric universe theory?
Yes, I have. I've looked into that, and it is an alternative theory to what we think we know about the sun now, which relates to the structure of it and how its energy is generated. For me, the main point is the actual nature of the sun, the nature of it being a conscious living entity, and what mechanism drives that is of scientific interest. But to me, that's the less point. So, but I do know that whatever powers it, all the stars are linked up by electromagnetic fields, as is our Earth to the sun. There's an electromagnetic field called a magnetic portal, which NASA discovered 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it's the diameter of Earth. It joins up between Earth and sun every 8.5 minutes. While tons of high energy particles pass back, or are believed to pass back and forth between it. And that's absolutely, it's there. And NASA said they wouldn't have believed it before they discovered it. And those sort of electromagnetic fields are connecting our stars to other stars. So the whole galaxy is linked up with information going back and forth, because that's what you do with electromagnetic fields. We send radio signals, television, through electromagnetic fields. All of our Wi-Fi is done like that, x-rays, MRI scans. But fungi, bacteria, plants communicate with photons. The cells in our body do. So we see all these stars are joined up by electromagnetic fields. And you know, it's obviously not random. They're there for a purpose.
What do you think about the people who say they can live on sunlight, that they don't eat, they just bathe in the sun, and that gives them all their nutrients?
I do sun gazing as well, but I have never done it, you know, steadily every day. You can't really do that living in England. I mean, I love it. I really get a charge out of sun gazing. I also love my food, and I've never noticed my appetite going down. So I don't dismiss anything, but there are a lot of things in this world that you have to see to believe. And I have never seen or experienced that, so I'm not a believer or a non-believer, but maybe there is some way that through our pineal gland we can do whatever the human equivalent of photosynthesis is and convert air, water, and sunlight into the carbohydrates and, you know, structures of the vegetable world. I know, you know, some of the people who claim to do this have, I think, been examined by scientists and doctors. But again, maybe not. It would certainly be a good skill to have if come Armageddon and food supplies being disrupted.
True. So. Looking at the sun as a conscious entity, it wouldn't be conscious in the way that we think of consciousness or self-awareness, because obviously it's something very different. What does this idea kind of do to our understanding of consciousness?
Well, our understanding of consciousness is, you know, if you're on a scale of 1 to 10, it's about 1.5. About the only thing people agree about on consciousness is that it's the greatest mystery of our existence. And as you know, there are a large number of scientists,
even regard consciousness as an illusion that has some some useful part to play, but that in fact everything we do is predetermined by the arrangement of particles at the Big Bang. So it's really kind of arrogant for us to have this greatest mystery of our existence that somehow we can say, well, at least we know only we have it, maybe, and nothing else does. How the hell can you say that? We do know it's some kind of an invisible thing, because when we're dead, it's not stuck in our body. As are the bones and neurons and teeth and everything else. So it is kind of a matter-free thing. And we do see the sun has this huge matter-free part of it called the corona, which takes up more space than the sun itself, which is this complex electromagnetic field. Again, solar scientists say that the corona is the most mysterious aspect of the sun. And even though they say it's that mysterious, they do say that it is controlling and managing sunspots, stars, coronal filaments, and coronal mass ejections, which are sort of unpredictable. We've been trying to figure them out for hundreds of years, what they're doing and when and why. So scientists say, well, they're being run by this mysterious thing called the corona. Well, I don't think I'm putting two together here and getting the wrong answer, I would say that that's where the sun's mind is operating from. And what it's thinking about, don't ask me. I mean, I wouldn't expect the mind to know what I'm thinking about at this moment.
And as you said, there's a lot we don't know about the sun. I mean, it seems like there's probably more we don't know than do know.
Absolutely.
One of the things you talk about here is where we draw the line between what's animate and inanimate. And that's definitely a fuzzy line.
It certainly is. And as I was very interested to find out that scientifically, usually plants have been considered inanimate. And I can't really see why they haven't. Recognize because plants breathe. Most of the dictionary definitions of animate include plants.
Are plants that can actually move in a visible way.
Absolutely. So let's include plants for the argument here. And when I was looking at that, I kept finding examples of stuff we call inanimate that are actually animate, like tornadoes and hurricanes and crystals and oceans and full weather systems, and we constantly see inanimate elements behave in an animate way, and we even have weird things happening, like when we lose stuff and you sort of give up looking for it and suddenly it reveals itself. What's going on there? And I just got a funny take, when I used to, because we don't have, it's more of a paperless society today, but paperclips used to be an essential part of office stuff, and they'd always join themselves up together into long, chains of paperclips somehow when you weren't looking. But you do, you and the inanimate, what we call animate is such a tiny, tiny fraction of this living universe, and of course you would have to call the sun inanimate, even though it's the most active thing you could possibly imagine. And it's, as I think I mentioned earlier, some of the layers within it rotate around each other at different speeds, and I found suddenly realized you can't really draw a distinction between the animate and the inanimate. It's a sort of silly thing to try and do.
And I think that applies to consciousness too. I mean, we can see different levels of consciousness, and where do you draw a line over what's conscious and what's not? Some people would say, well, animals aren't really conscious, but they behave very much like they are. So where does that kind of argument come out of?
I mean, we share something like 50% of our genes with cabbages. and everything's got electrons spinning around it, has got an electromagnetic field. So there's something going on, and of course, 99% of everything, of the space within it, is saturated with the electromagnetic field. As I said earlier, that's what gives it its nature, and that permeates everything. And if you can make the very hard to comprehend leap to that force as being the divine energetic living force of the universe, you could in a sense look at us as renting space in it. I mean, we don't know where our consciousness fits. I mean, you don't think of it as something that extends 18 inches around your head in a concentric circle. It's like it's outside of those sort of geometric physical boundaries. And, you know, we can, you know, in some perhaps states of ecstatic enlightenment during meditation, somebody's mind might expand to fill the universe. And some people's minds, you know, never get beyond what type of car they're driving and how big their house is. It's like a, I really think, you know, we have a fantastic instrument for tuning into consciousness, which is probably our brain, but also our heart and all the cells in our body are in a sense tuned into this conscious force. But our brain, with its hundreds of thousands of kilometers of connections, is a great thing that interprets it and uses it and channels it. And when we're taking in this electromagnetic force from the sun, with its sun's light, which has been stored in plants, or animals eat the plants, then we eat those foods, and we're taking that solar energy into our body, that conscious solar energy into our body, and we're reconfigurating it into the energy of a human life, which is fantastic. And a tree is taking that energy in and turning it into the life of a tree, in this form of a tree, and feeding all those living colonies of bacteria and fungi in the soil that are converting food from the earth to supply the roots of the trees, in these incredibly connected, joined up relationships that show many of the manifestations of intelligence as they design themselves to feed each other and, you know, work together in all these wonderful symbiotic relationships between plants, animals, fungi, and bacteria.
You take a good amount of time on here explaining how we may have consciousness in things as small as cells, and showing that there could be free will among even what we think of as inanimate objects.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a
crazy one to think about, isn't it? I know it's tough, and that's why I had to write a whole book about it, so there's kind of enough backdrop that when people get the stuff, they don't think it's that crazy. But, you know, when you look at a single cell in the human body, there are 5 to 10 million components in that cell. And each one of it is, in a sense, doing its own thing, because those 5 or 10 million components, they're taking in nourishment, they're repairing damage, they're receiving signals from other cells, sending signals to other cells, they're duplicating themselves when they divide, creating an entire copy of themselves. Stem cells change into bones when they need to be bones, or teeth, tongues when they need to be tongues. And there's not like some central controller who's doing all of that. And it's sort of hard to rule out the suggestion that each cell is doing these things itself, and it's because of the bottom-up intelligence of all the little cells within it, because you do see bottom-up organization. All these sort of molecules of water in the air create a weather system. And it's using wind and air pressure and temperature and all that other stuff. So you see that bottom-up self-organization happening. And if some form of primal consciousness, the electromagnetic forces, is infusing that, you know, that's probably what's playing a part, what's doing it, what's enabling that function.
Well, I would think that, like, when you look at the Earth, I mean, a lot of people are familiar with the Gaia theory.
Yeah.
But if you look at the Earth, we could say that we're all the different cells in the body of the Earth, which is in itself a different consciousness.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's that consciousness is built up from all of us, all of the plankton blooms in the oceans that are moderating our climate. I mean, it's just, it is. It's a single, and we're all part of it. It's bizarre to sort of think that we're above it and somehow the only intelligent thing on this whole Earth. It's a really dumb thing to think.
Well, I think it's also that we don't recognize things that don't think the way we do as being conscious.
And that's partly because if you read Genesis, that's pretty much how it reads. That, you know, we are conscious, God, Satan, and angels are conscious, and dumb, dead matter that was put here for our convenience and our use. Yeah, and you know, once telescopes were, you know, once Galileo invented the telescope, it became obvious that the whole universe was not created with human beings in mind.
And even like when you look at the like the SETI project, you know, searching for radio waves from other cultures, it's an assumption that they're going to develop and communicate in the same way we do, and I don't think that's likely.
You know, I told you about my recognition of the sun as conscious when I was 17. Mm-hmm. The only time that I ever brought it up in public was when people were asking me about the SETI project. Because I thought, maybe there are other things kind of like us out there with, you know, three legs and, you know, half an hour, five, whatever. But, you know, we still don't recognize the most major consciousness, intelligent consciousness in our neighborhood, which is the sun, you know. And I that's the only time I couldn't hold it in my solar field. I thought, well, hey, let's look at this one first. But yeah, whether they have, I mean, I think there's got to be other life forms out there. And as you say, how they've developed, where their consciousness has led them, whether they have computers or not, I don't know. I do have a chapter in my first book, The State is Out of Date, which is called What Would an Alien Think? And it makes the point that an alien landing on Earth would probably be defenseless because the weapons of mass destruction that we're great at producing are the sign of a higher intelligence. And of course, obviously, quite the opposite is true. And, you know, alien intelligence that is highly developed probably never had the desire to split the atom to create that sort of massive destruction. That doesn't go with sustainable cultures. And they'd probably be horrified to land on Earth and look at all the ways we could kill each other. keep a low profile.
So there seems to be a connection between the structure of, like, galaxies and the structure of the human brain.
Well, the similarity is that they are both joined up systems, and in our brain, each neuron is connected to up to a few thousand other neurons through synapses. And synapses aren't hardwired connections; they join up to the other neuron, and then there's a little gap. across that gap, biochemicals and electric photons pass. Now, in stars in a galaxy, you've got about the same number of stars in the Milky Way as we have neurons in our brains, and they are all joined up by the electromagnetic fields I was talking about earlier. It's a very new to cosmology, so we don't know whether each star is connected to five other stars or 1,000 other stars, but you have that same sort of connection between, you know, hundreds of billions of stars as you have with the neurons. Yes.
All right. Are you aware of the binary star theories about our sun, that we might be in a binary star system?
Well, yeah, I believe that we are, that Sirius is the partner to our star. I'm quite firmly convinced of that, actually, by Walter Cruttenton's book, Lost Star of Myth and Time. But that's another point. Most stars have a partner. And as they travel through the cosmos together, spinning around each other like a couple of figure skaters. And then the stars live in communities called clusters, which are joined up. So they manifest a lot of things that might make you think they're a living system, the way they behave. So, yeah.
Well, I would think that would also have an effect. If the sun has such an effect on us, another star moving closer to us is also going to have a completely different effect on us as well.
Yeah, well, in Walter Crutton's book, he talks about different ages of man being predicated by where Sirius was in relation to our sun.
Yeah. And it's a really fascinating theory to me.
I was mind blown. I really enjoyed his book, yeah.
Yeah, I picked it up on a whim, and I was completely blown away. He's actually the first person I ever interviewed on this type of subject matter.
Really? Great.
Yeah. In the afterwards of your book, you talk about the unique properties of water.
Right.
And what I always found fascinating is Masaru Emoto's work? Is that his name?
Masaru Emoto, that's right, yes.
Yeah. And how he can show that emotion can imprint on water.
That's true. I was also very turned on by Victor Schauberger, who was a German scientist. Originally was a forester. But he did a lot of work on water, the living nature of water itself. And he had a very spiritual and physical, like mechanical understanding of how water worked. I mean, anybody who's been turned on by Masaru Emoto, I would really recommend they look at Victor Schauberger to get a real depth of feeling for what water is about, as well as the sort of pictures that it might make in relation to different stimuli.
Okay. You also talk about light, and one of the things you suggest is that light doesn't experience time, and that was a little mind-blowing to think about.
It's quite well established that when you travel at the speed of light, there is no time. That's why if you go faster than the speed of light, you would go backwards in time. But at that little balancing point, you're neither going forwards and no back nor backwards, which means that a photon is always living in the now. And it's interesting when you have people coming back from near-death experience, they often mention seeing their life flash before them in an instant,
right?
Because they're a being of light while they're having that experience. And, you know, it might help explain why when light travels from Sirius to the back of our eyeballs, 1,000 photons a second coming into the back of our eyeball, and they've come all the way from Sirius, so it's 81 trillion miles, and for 8.5 years, they've been on that journey. But they don't stop to be recharged on the way. You know, it's like, for them, it's nothing.
True.
They're outside of time and space.
Yeah, and I never thought about it like that. But as you said in the book, it would be there's no sense of time passing for light, because light is kind of what we measure time by in some sense.
Yeah, and then maybe the passage of light is actually what's creating the time and the space. You know, it is. It's the one thing that is agreed. It's the most unfathomable, beyond our light itself. It's, and this is something that the ancient mystic Zoroaster and Akhenaten, who they both recognized light as the ultimate deity in the universe, with God being, with the sun being its local representative. And it's interesting, I studied them quite a bit, and a lot of the things they say about light are exactly the same things that quantum physicists talk about light, about being timeless, beyond comprehension, without form, you know, primal energy.
You got to wonder, too, if all these ancient cultures worshipped the sun and had this reverence for light, if this was something that was handed down by a more advanced ancient culture.
You could wonder that, but I think Zoroaster and Akhenaten were pretty much on their own, and it didn't survive. When Akhenaten died, he was buried. We didn't discover he existed until the mid-19th century, and he was 1500 BC. And Zoroastrians and Parsians are still an active religion, but there's only the 250,000 of them. So the idea sort of came, and then it got morphed into the Abrahamic religions, where you had a god who was a light dispensing god, but he created it. He wasn't light himself. He had created it like he created mountains and Eve out of Adam's rib. So it was still a god of light, but it was a serious downgrade from this all-pervasive one. So I think they just had amazing insights, because we don't find many instances of that percept before them.
Okay. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Gregory Sams.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, link section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And we've been speaking tonight on Where Did the Road Go with Gregory Sams, author of Son of God, and an old book that you just republished, which is called what?
It's called The State is Out of Date, We Can Do It Better.
Nice. And originally, that what you said that was published in 98?
It was published in 98, that's correct.
And why did you decide to republish?
Well, because its time has come. It was in 1998. It was absolutely on the mark. People who really got it. But the idea that the state was perhaps never going to sort things out and didn't really have our best interests in heart and wasn't the mechanism to deal with the problems solving or facing the world was alien to them. People in 98 thought they're going to sort it out. But since 1998 and 2013, the mask has dropped in many ways, and many, many more people realize that we're being run by crooks and gangsters or people who are in the pockets of big business. That this whole, and I make the fundamental point, though, that ruling by running things by coercion doesn't work. You know, when you're fighting wars, when you're stopping Hitler and Napoleon, yeah, you need coercion. Maybe when you're dealing with murderers and thieves, you need coercion. But when you're running agriculture and health and human behavior and what we eat and how many hours a week we work and what sort of a house we live in, this coercive, do this, do it this way, or we're going to damage you. That's the basic rule that they all use. You get weird results. And the point I make is we do that stuff much better. We end up with trade bodies, consumer groups that really work out, iron out, you know, things like how our ballpoint pens work and, you know, what size to make, you know, to sell your bottles of wine in. And I mean, I heard about some poor beer brewer, a boutique beer brewer in California, who's possibly going to go bankrupt because with the government shut down, you know, that shut down the day that the status update came out, he can't get his new beer labels approved. He's got a whole new range of beer to go out, but you've got to have your label approved by the state. You know, you've got to have, you know, there's legislation on what shape cucumbers are and what type of apples you can grow. And you go to jail or get fined if you defy these rules. And that's not the way to run our society. And that's the point I make in this book.
And it's proving itself very well, as you said. Do you think this whole GMO thing is going to be stopped at some point, or do you think that will eventually overrun everything?
It hasn't gotten out of America to much of a degree at all yet. I mean, you get it in animal feed over here, but not on the shelves, generally speaking. I sure hope it fades out, because it's again, it's something that could only happen allowing it. It's you know, the state guaranteeing it and underwriting it and telling Monsanto or GMO producers that they're inured from any fines or liabilities for what they're doing. It's appalling. It's and I do hope that, you know, enough people in America get outraged enough about it to actually roll it back rather than see it rolling forward into ever more and more foods.
You know, it doesn't seem the American people have much of a say, even if they do see it.
It's tough.
Oh, you look at the war with Syria and how so many Americans were against it, but they were still planning on going forward with it. It didn't really matter all that much to them.
I know, that was that. Well, that's what I talk about when I talk about the mask is dropping. We had it here. Nobody wanted to go to war with Iraq in England. We had the largest demonstration in the history of mankind, 2 million people at that point. And England still went to war. So it was, I mean, for the clever footplay chess move by Russia and Syria to suddenly, you know, make it impossible for America to, for the military to juggernaut to go ahead. But yeah, that was scary. And I think that opened a lot of Americans' eyes to the fact that maybe America isn't the well-meaning global policeman spreading democracy that they've been told it is.
Well, I think, unfortunately, at this point, America almost seems to be the bad guy to many countries in the world.
Well, not without good cause.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is really sad.
Now, did you have a... What spawned you to write this book in the first place?
I had taken some courses and had inputs. I read Lao Tzu, the Chinese philosopher, when I was very young, and he really quite influenced me. And he said, you know, I think that the more laws and regulations, the more thieves and robbers you'll have, and the more knives and guns, the more. And it was very interesting stuff. I also ran my own business. When I got into natural organic foods, it was through the teachings of George Osawa, a Japanese macrobiotic teacher. And he said, you take responsibility yourself for everything that happens in your life, which is why you have to eat good food. Then I had a course on free enterprise. And the real value of free enterprise, of people forming connections, And the impossibility of achieving your ends through coercive behavior. But I still needed more. Then I discovered chaos theory. And chaos theory was kind of a scientific backing to all these other inputs, cables in my life, the threads in my life, if you like. And then through chaos theory in my shop, I got sucked back into the counterculture. I started going to these sort of illegal parties in warehouses and fields, and then sometimes whole festivals. And I went to go and saw the parties there. And there I saw self-organization taking place. Somebody would have an idea to have a party or a festival, and the music would come together. The bar would come together, the sound system would come together, and nobody would have to pay anything because everybody was getting something out of it, and it just self-assembled out of an idea. And so I saw, and then you see it in the festival where there are 10,000 or 20,000 people, and you've got catering and toilets and music, and it's all, well, you know, we catered the very first Glastonbury Festival in 71. So that I saw chaos theory, free enterprise, Lao Tzu, all of this stuff was coming together, and I thought, right, I've got to write about this because this is the way forward. And of course, that was me seeing it live. But then, you know, in a historical time scale, you can look at the Wright brothers, invented their airplane. They're two bicycle mechanics. They didn't plan the airline industry, that's self-assembled in the years that followed.
It's a very interesting way of looking at it. Obviously the government tries to regulate more and more stuff nowadays, which you even point out in Son of God that it kind of causes things to get completely imbalanced.
Really? And it's just, you look at all the things that we actually like in life, whether it's our clothes or our music or our lighting or electricity or houses or cars or computers or phones or bicycles, you know, they're all things that came out of humanity. They all came out of the chaos of billions of human beings mixing with each other, moving around, building things, and none of them were created by the state. And then the state comes in and says, well, we've got to regulate it. So, and it's just, they don't regulate, they mess it up. And then we get in a situation where they get managed by corporations who can pull strings and actually uneven the marketplace. So we don't have free enterprise. We've got enterprise that's so regulated that you have to be a multinational to comply with all the damned rules and to hire the people to do all the stuff and fill in all the boxes and tick all of that. It really kills free enterprise. And guerrilla restaurants we hear about, because I always made that point, why can't I open up a restaurant in my kitchen? Why should there be 101 laws that stop me doing that in my own home? And those 101 laws, you know, the result is that our catering is dominated by McDonald's, Kentucky Fried Chicken, Burger King, you know, milkshake. I hope you don't get sued for this, but you know, this is all the food we get because that's the result of, you know, the government keeping our food supply safe. Hello.
Well, isn't there something to, like, you know, to that point of keeping things safe to some degree, making sure people are following at least basic health codes?
Yeah, but look what's happened as a result of the government doing that. When you have when you belong to a trade guild, like an architect, whether an architect or a lawyer, and trade guilds, you know, were always a feature of developing business from medieval times onwards, and they set standards. So if you wanted to be in that guild, you had to know about baking bread, not mix sawdust in with it. You had to be a good lawyer, know how to build houses, and if you want to, you know. We have online monitors of restaurants and hotels with TripAdvisor, so you can go and you can see if people say this was a horrible restaurant, the service was terrible, I got sick after they ate there. That's a mechanism which eventually puts that restaurant out of business. True. You have eBay and Amazon sell loads of stuff across all areas. you get ripped off by suppliers there, they refund your money, it was eased out of the system, and they do all that without police, jails, or judges. It's like we're doing that. We do that stuff much better and much cheaper and much more effective than the state does. And the state, something, they turn problems into institutions that they live off of sometimes. So, yeah, I think, you know, we're able to... Yeah, go on.
No, go ahead.
No, I just think we are, you know, when we have the tools to self-regulate and the need to have decent restaurants, we're able to do that sort of stuff and to create standards that raise the tone of our civilization rather than lower it.
All right. And where can people... Do you have, like, a main website?
Yeah, my main website is GregorySams.com.
And that's just SAMS.
MS.com. But also I've got a dedicated little website for the state is out of date, which is the stateisoutofdate.com. The first, the one book is The State is Out of Date, We Can Do It Better, which is available for the price of a cup of coffee digitally on all your digital platforms. It's coming out as a print book in April. And then Son of God, print or digital, that's S-U-N of God, of course. And that's available through any Amazon or any other online bookseller.
Okay. And when the other one comes out, it'll also be available everywhere, I assume?
Yes, for sure. For sure. Yeah, they're both being published by Red Wheel Weiser, sort of large American publisher. So they get the books out there. That's their job. I produce the books and promote them.
Nice. And I see Graham Hancock wrote the foreword to Son of God as
well. Yeah, he wrote the foreword to that. And he was introduced to that because he read a copy of State is Out of Date in its first incarnation. Mm-hmm. And he loved it. He told me he was punching the air as he was reading it. So when I did Son of God, he said, yeah, I sent him a couple chapters up, and he said I'd be honored to write a foreword for it. So that was great.
That's awesome. All right. Is there anything else people should know?
I don't think so. We've covered a lot of ground here.
All right. Well, maybe we can have you back when the book comes out in print next year.
Okay. I'd love to.
Okay. And I thank you for talking to us.
Okay.
We're going to play some Psyche Corporation to take you out. The Last Exit for the Lost is up next.
Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection? To perfection. 5, 8, 3. Have you heard the singing soaking into our transmission? 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Whence came this dream? Or static or magic. Now it's time. to be wary, you are getting to the heart of the universe. Venture calls and Tatriot, chambers number 1597. And counting. And counting. Can you hear the ballet in place? The whirring of the world.
The whirring of the world.
Can you hear the ballet in place? The whirring of the world.
The whirring of the world.
Can you hear? Can you hear the ballet in place? The whirring of the world. Can you hear the ballet in place? The whirring of the world.
The whirring of the world.
You're tuned to WVBR FM Ithaca.